Okay. I've told you in the past that Rav Soloveitchik was very, very adamant about the idea that it's not an original idea with him, but he developed it in very unique ways. The idea that the stories in Chumash, especially in Chumash, are prototypes of what's going to happen to the Jewish people in the future. The person who coined this idea in the best known way was Ramban, who said Maseh Avot Siman Labanim, that whatever happened to the patriarchs is indicative of what's going to happen, of a dynamic that's going to actually characterize Jewish history for all time. So actually, if you want to really know if you want to understand the world you live in, a good place to start is, believe it or not, is in Chumash. So this week's parsha is a good example of that, because the parsha has all kinds of interesting and amazing stories, and starts off with the meeting, or the I'm not going to say reconciliation, but the reunion of sorts between Yaakov and Esau. Okay, so it's not really like a happy reunion. Like nobody went out to Sushi Rechavia to go and have I know it to make you up. There were two of them. There's one of them in Katamon, and there's another one on the place that you all know is Amek.
Yeah. We're going.
There were two of them. All right. Anyways. Okay. So, but the question is not whether you can say sushi. The question was if you can eat sushi. Okay. Anyways. In any event, it wasn't like this really huggy huggy kissy kissy thing, the way that, although they did hug and kiss, but we all know that he didn't mean it, right? That's why there are little dots over the letters Vayishakehu, because we know that he didn't really mean it, Esav. The point is that the relationship between Yaakov and Esav is consistently seen by Chazal, especially, as not just the story of two brothers, but about two different peoples, two different types, two different civilizations. Yaakov symbolizes who? Who's Yaakov in the historical swing of things?
One of the three gods.
Right, which means it's us. And Esav symbolizes what? Everybody know?
The Arabs.
No, on the contrary. There are two perpetual foes, I'm not looking for the word foe, rivals or people you have to deal with. One is Yishmael and the other one is Esav. Yishmael is the Arabs. By their own, not just by, because Chumash says so, the Arabs themselves say that they are the descendants of Yishmael. In fact, according to Islamic lore, Abraham tried to offer up his son Ismail on an altar at the Kaaba in Mecca in Saudi Arabia. In other words, instead of Akedat Yitzchak, it's actually Akedat Yishmael. Because in general, the Christianity, like Islam, both are what's called supersessionist religions, which mean that they actually knock out the previous religions out of the box. In the case of Christianity, Christians claim that they are the real Judaism. Christianity is the real Judaism, and the Christians are the real Israel. We're going to come back to that in a minute. And Islam says that, in fact, all previous revelations are no longer valid at all once Muhammad came and gave the Quran and so on and so forth. Okay, so it's ironic, perhaps, that so much time has been spent on the relations between, or the ongoing competition or opposition between Esav and Yaakov, between Christianity and Judaism, when in fact today our major challenge comes not from Esav, or apparently, but from Yishmael. Nevertheless, it's important. I want to use the story of Yaakov's reuniting with Esav, or his reunion with Esav, in order to sort of present you with an important episode that happened in the Rav's life, and which was in the movie a little bit, and also which brought him to develop an essay and an idea which is actually, as of yesterday, very, very current. Okay? Now, according to Chumash, let's start here. So it's always good to start with the with the text. So yeah, so what happens is that Yaakov comes back and he crosses and he's on his way back to Eretz Yisrael, and he knows he's going to have to deal with Esav. Esav in the meantime has gotten married, he's got kids, he's got a kingdom, all in Seir in Edom, which is where? Anybody know where Edom is? What's Eretz Edom? Where is it?
Jordan?
Yes, exactly. It's right here on the map. Good map. Good idea. It's all right here. This is Eretz Edom. Okay. Here is Ammon. Here is Moab, and here is this whole area is Eretz Edom. Okay. So Yaakov knows he's going to deal with him, and so he gets word that Esav is coming with an army. He's coming with how many people? I didn't take a look. I think 400 people, but I'm not sure. Yeah. He's coming with 400 men. 400 men is an army. Okay? Armies in or small army. Armies in the ancient period are not huge. I mean, maybe there's a few thousand. I mean, the Roman legions had a few thousand men in them per legion. Sometimes you could get up to 20, 30,000 people, but that was like really extreme. Kingdoms were won and lost on relatively small armed forces. 400 armed men versus Yaakov's little tribe over there, extended family with four wives and whatever. Even if he has a few armed retainers, Esav will have him for breakfast. So he comes, and Yaakov sends him a present, and he a whole bunch of presents, and he prays, and he gets ready to be able to absorb an attack. He divides the camp into different stages, into different sections, so that part of his families will survive an attack by Esav. And then he's all alone, and the Torah tells us, "Vayeyavek ishimo adalot ha-shachar," and somebody struggled with him. Somebody until dawn. Who's the Ish? We'll get to that in a second. Vayar, and the Ish, unstated, unknown person, saw Kilo Yakolo, saw that he couldn't beat Yaakov physically. Vayak Vayiga Bekafrag Yericho, he gave him a sucker punch. You know sucker punches? Sucker punches is like below the belt. You give him a sucker punch, and he hit him in the ball and socket in his hip. Vateka kafyerech Yaakov beavkoimo, and Yaakov dislocated his thigh. Vayomer, and he said to him, Shalchini kela shachar, let me go because it's dawn already. We don't know what difference that makes. Vayomer lo ashalechecha kim berachtani, I'm not going to let you go unless you bless me. Vayomer elav mashmecha, and he says, what's your name? And Yaakov tells him, Yaakov. Vayomer lo Yaakov yamer od shemecha, your name is no longer Yaakov, ki im Yisrael. It's now going to be called Yisrael, which is a much more majestic, a much more dignified, a much more majestic is actually the word, a much more royal type name. Kisarita im Elokim v'im anashim v'tuchal, where you have striven with the powerful, or with angels, or you have according to the Targum, you have fought before God. V'imanashim, you've struggled with men, v'tuchal, and you have prevailed, or you will prevail. And then Yaakov said, "Vayomer Yaakov, Vayishal Yaakov, Vayomer Hagidin Ashmecha. Tell me what your name is. Vayomer Lamazet Yishal Lishmi. Why are you asking what my name is? What's your business?" Vayivarecho Tosham. So he gave him brecha. At that point, Vayikra Yaakov Shema Makom Pniel. Yaakov called the place the face of God. Ki ra'iti Elohim panim el panim v'tinatzel nafshi. I saw God face to face, and I was saved, and my soul was saved. Obviously, he realizes that this guy who's struggling with is more than just your average schlepper who's hanging around. This must be an angel. Vayizrach lo Hashemesh, and the sun came up when he was walking through Penuel, and he was limping, and that's why Jews don't eat the sciatic nerve in the back of the cow, because Yaakov was actually injured in his sciatic nerve, which goes up and down the leg from the ball and socket from the spine. Okay, there's a lot to say about this story. Okay, but there's a few things that I want to zoom in on. Number one,
number one. Who is this guy? Who's the Ish? This unnamed person who wrestles with Yaakov, and why is he wrestling? What's the point? So he's a malach. So what? Why malachim have nothing else to do? I mean, what are they doing? They belong to WWF, the World Wrestling Federation, and that's all there is. No. Okay. What kind of test? Of his strength. What kind of strength? And why does a physical test? Why does it have to be that kind of test? Abraham Avinu was tested 10 times. Most of the times there were questions of faith. So why is it physical? Okay. Well, if it's Saroshel Esav, if it was Esav's malach, so what would that tell you? Why did he need to have physical strength? Right. In other words, he had to show he wasn't only just strong in spiritual sense, that he was also strong in a physical sense, and he had at least notice he had to at least call it a draw. And the only way initially that the Esav thought to be able to get at him was by a sucker punch, by an illegal below the belt hit, and in the end Yaakov pinned him anyways. Okay, which would indicate that whatever the Saro Shel Esav symbolizes, Yaakov will be able to overcome it anyways. Okay, so that's number one. The Rav used to point something else out. There are a number of occasions in Chumash, okay, where a person appears who is not named, but rather just said a person, a kid, a young person, whatever the case might be. All right. Why not mention who they are? And the matter sometimes does, okay? But why not tell us who these person are? Mysterious people? The Ish. What is the Ish thing? So I give you three examples. One is actually not an Ish, one is actually the case of a kid. Remember Avraham Avinu was traveling around with Lot, and then Lot was hanging out in the area of Sodom. Remember that?
Yeah.
So Lot was hanging around Sodom, and the king of Sodom and his allies revolted against a bunch of other kings, including the king of Babylonia. And there was a big war that took place on the other side, actually, of the Dead Sea, on that side, in the Ammon Moab area. It was before Ammon and Moab, but anyways, in that area of the Dead Sea, on the northern part of the northern shores of the Dead Sea. The western shores, rather, of the eastern shores of the Dead Sea, sorry. Anyways, the combined forces of the allies against Sodom, there was five kings against the four, and the four beat the five. Okay, they beat and conquered the kings of Sodom, Amora, Admat, Zoyim, and Soar. I used to say that was the five towns. Sodom, Amora, Admat, Zoyim, and Soar. All these really, you know. Anyway, not nice to say after Sandy, but anyway. In any event, so they came and they beat them. And what happened? And they took Lot captive. Okay, so what happened? Vayavo ha-palit. Some refugee, some guy who ran away. He goes all the way to Elon Mamre on the other side, inside near Kiryat Arba, near Hebron, and he says to Avram, you know, Lot was taken captive. So what happens? Avram takes his small army, okay, also a few hundred men, and he goes and chases after the king of Sodom and Amora, you got the king of Babylon and so on, catches them up north near the Golan, and he beats them. And he rescues Lot. Okay? Hapalit. We know who he is. Chazal say he might be old, but the Torah decides to keep him anonymous. Okay? It's a palit. Right? Here we have an Ish.
Here we have an Ish who is wrestling with Yaakov. We have no idea. And in fact, Yaakov says, "What's your name?" And the truth of the matter is that the Torah won't tell us. I mean, and this guy, we assume he's a Malach, won't tell us. Okay. There's another case where there's an Ish. It's actually not in next week's Sedra. Okay. One of the great, I guess, can't help it, spoiled brats of all time. His name was. Who was the most spoiled child?
Yosef,
correct. Do you see the movie, by the way? The Joseph, King of Dreams? Real? I think it's King of Dreams, right? Prince of Dreams. Anyway, you should watch it. It's on YouTube. Watch it. It's actually based on Midrashim and stuff, too, because they had good... I have actually a friend who was was the Hollywood consultant for Moses, Prince of Egypt. So they picked him up at the airport.
Well, we're watching that.
Okay. No, you're watching Commandments. Yeah. Now, Prince of Egypt is another ballgame. In any event, I mean, they're different. They're different. In any event, and I'm right now reading Herman Wouk's new novel called The Lawgiver, which is all about making a movie about Moses, which is, it's an interesting book by itself, which I highly recommend. Because, you know, he's religious. Herman Wouk. You've never heard of Herman Wouk, right? No. Herman Wouk is one of the great authors of the 20th century. He wrote Winds of War, War and Remembrance, The Glory, The Hope, Marjorie Morningstar's No Way Over It, The Caine Mutiny, which is also became an Academy Award winning film. Anyways, not important. Yosef's brothers can't stand him, and they go off to go tend the sheep, and Yaakov wanted to check up on them. So he sends Yosef after them. Okay, so let's see, where is this? This is in, if take a look, and this is Perek Lamed Zayin, Pasuk Yudalit. Vayomer lo lechna re'ei et shlom achecha. Go and take a look at check out how your brothers are doing. The et shlom atzon. See how the sheep are doing. Vashiveni davar. How the sheep are doing, I can always tell you, because I get stuck in traffic more often by sheep than anything else. Vayishlacheu me'emek Chevron. So he sent them out from Chevron. Vayavo shchema. So in other words, he sent them right up. Here is Chevron. Okay, this is Route 60, which goes all the way to Damascus ultimately. Okay, here's Hebron. So they were in this area, and he sent the brothers to check out how he's doing to Shechem, straight up the highway, straight up the mountain ridge. Okay, and he gets to a place called Dotan, which is right here. Right, that's the Ishlap. That's a Ishlap. That's by car. That's an hour and a half. Right. I really did it because I went to Har Gerizim on Chol HaMoed. It's okay. So he gets to he sent him towards Shechem. That's where they were pastoring. Vayimtzaehu ish, and an anonymous, the mysterious guy, get appears. Vayimtzaehu ish, vihinei toeh basadeh, and he sees that Yosef is lost. Believe me, without Waze, without GPS, it's easy to get lost up there. Vayishalehu ish lemor matzvakesh, and the man asked him, "What are you looking for?" Vayomer etachai anochi mevakesh. I'm looking for my brothers. Hagidah ali. Tell me, please, Ephohim Roim. Do you know where they're? Where are they? You know, where are they grazing your sheep? Vayomer ha'ish. Again, ha'ish. When the Torah doesn't say stuff just stam kacha, the Torah doesn't just repeat itself. Okay, that would be philosophically and morally, believe it or not, problematic. Okay. Because if the Torah repeats something over and over again, all right, that would mean that God repeated it. If there was no reason for that, right, then we would have to say that God did something which had no purpose, and it's philosophically impossible for God to do something with no purpose. God, by definition, is purposeful. So therefore, if the Torah is given by God, that's our belief. That is our belief. Then therefore, if the Torah keeps hacking away at repeating a certain word, it's trying to get a point across. There was something special about this ish. this anonymous, mysterious person. There are plenty of places where the Torah says, Vayomer, Vayomer, so-and-so, Vayomer, so-and-so, and then they say, Vayomer, 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 and you have to sit there and figure out who's talking to what as part of the conversation. We just had a case like that. The Malach doesn't say, the Malach, Vayomer, Aish. Here it's Aish, Aish, Aish. Okay? We'll come back to that. So he says, Vayomer, Aish, Nasa'u Mizeh. He said, they're no longer here. Kishamati Otam Omrim, Leichad Dotaina. Sorry. He made it to Shechem, and he sent them off to, the brothers were in Dotan, which is off where I showed you. Let's go to Dotan. Vayelech Yosef Acharecha, Vayimtzayim B'Dotan. We found them in Dotan. Okay. Now, if you think about it, when you ask a question, so Rabbi asked the question, he asked on a number of occasions, that's the following question. What is this Ish? Who is this guy? Why is there obviously not the same person, but why is it that there's an anonymous person who comes in at specific times and doesn't get he's mysterious. He doesn't get mentioned, he doesn't get identified. Why is that? So let's think about the options. Okay? If there's a thing in historians called counterfactuals. That's a fancy word for saying what if. What if the Japanese had not attacked Pearl Harbor? What if the United States hadn't dropped an atomic bomb? What if JFK had not been killed? You know, this past week was the yahrzeit of President John F. Kennedy, who was assassinated on November 22nd, 1963. It's not a date that means anything to you guys, but for those of us who lived through it, it's one of those things where you know where you were when you heard about it. Like, I know exactly where I was when I heard about Yitzhak Rabin being assassinated. I guess for you guys it would be like 9/11. Okay, you know where you were. I've had a lot of those times like that. Anyways, in any event, so that's a counterfactual. So yeah, it's a game you play. You sit there and say, well, had that not happened, based on everything that was going on, how would things have played out otherwise? Okay? So let's take the first case. You have a war. There's a rebellion of the five cities against the four cities. The Babylonians win. They take everybody away, including Lot. But nobody tells Avraham Avinu. So what would have happened? Or what wouldn't have happened?
Lot would not have been saved.
Lot would not have been saved. Okay. Since Lot would not have been saved, Sodom would not have been restored. Sodom would then not have been overturned later. Okay. Lot would not have run away with his daughters, and he would not have committed incest with his daughters. And therefore, the two sons of incest, Ammon and Moab, who occupy those two areas of the map, would not have been born. You'd say, so what? That's disgusting. That's true. Except that, who is somebody from Moab who we're interested in having born?
Ruth.
Ruth is a descendant of Lot and his daughter. Moab, Me'av. Okay? So, ultimately, if the Palit had not gotten Avram to go and save Lot, there would be no David HaMelech. Okay? Alright, another possibility. Had the fight not happened, and Avram Avinu not gone and beaten the other kings and saved the King of Stone, the King of Stone says, I'll give you whatever you want as a reward. Avraham Avinu says, I don't want anything for you. I don't want a shoelace from you. In response to that, God says, I will reward you. And up in the Golan at Nov, near Nov, God creates or enacts the Brit Ben Abtarim, which sets up the whole dynamic of Jewish history. That there will be a perpetual covenant between Abraham and his descendants, God, and that the Jews will go down to Egypt, and that they'll come out, and so on and so forth. The whole dynamic of Jewish history comes out of that one encounter, which is a direct result ensues directly upon the victory over the four kings. Okay, so this palit, who maybe would have come, maybe not. He's not exactly Avraham Avinu is down here, and the war battle's up there. He didn't have to come. The normal thing would be there's no regular communication. So it's not Facebook, okay? There's no internet. But the palit wouldn't come. Why would he schlep all the way down to Hebron? The palit, the refugee, by coming to Avraham Avinu, actually changes the normal course of history, which is not to know, especially in 1800 BCE. Okay, that's one. Number two. Let's skip number two. Let's go to number three. Yosef comes to Shechem. He doesn't find his brothers. Nobody knows where the brothers are. What does he do then? What would you do? Your father sends you out to look for your kids, for your brothers. Can't find them. You look around. You really ask around, and you can't find the person. You can't find them. So what do? No cell phones. No internet. No GPS. No nothing. So what do? What would be the normal thing to do? You asked, and nobody knows. The only guy that knew was this Ish. No? What do? You go home. Sorry, Dad. Don't know where they are. I tried, I looked, I went here, I went there, I bummed around, I tried to find this one, that one. Nobody heard of them, nobody saw them. The whole Shamron, the whole upper part of that area, that part of Israel is full of sheep. Nobody knows. They all look alike to me. Nobody wants to know from them. Farting. They don't like our people anyway so much, because don't forget we did a number on Shechem. This hasn't happened yet. Yeah, we did a number on Shechem. Like, last week's Parsha, no, this week's Parsha, okay? With the story of Dina. Sorry, go home. That's the normal thing. What happens if Yosef goes home? And then the brothers come home and farting. What doesn't happen? Or, better yet, what happens because this Ish comes and tells them where the brothers are? Look it up. It's not on my face. Look at my clothes. Right. And what happens because they're sold in Mitzrayim? He becomes a prince of Egypt, and he becomes the vizier, becomes the prime minister. Correct. In other words, the entire dynamic of Jewish history, of going down to Egypt, and Geulas Mitzrayim, which is the forerunner of the future Geula, and Moshe Rabbeinu, and Matan Torah, and Kibush Haaretz, and all this stuff, all depends on this Ish. Had he not been there, and Yosef had gone home, because he's there, he intervenes, and make sure and sets things on a normal course. In other words, what the Rav says is as follows: whenever the Torah interjects an Ish, an anonymous person, into the dynamic, into the story, it's where heaven has interfered in the normal way in which things would work, in order to divert history in an unexpected direction. Without the palit, there'd be no ge'ula. Without this ish, the second ish, that's why ha'ish ha'ish. Jewish history doesn't get off the ground. It stays a family affair of a few hundred people, maybe. You got to remember, Yetzias Mitzrayim is the formative experience of the Jewish people. Everything under the sun is Zeich Yetzias Mitzrayim. And it all depends on this ish. It's so formative. It's such a central part of consciousness, because at Brit Ben Abtarim, how much Torah did Avraham Avinu, did Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov have? Yeah, a couple of Nevuahs. No, they knew about Bris Milah. But the one thing they knew was this promise that God made at Brit Ben Abtarim, that Yadoa Tedaki Yezacha, Beretz Olehem Vabadum Vinu Otam Abamot Shana, and then whatever, however it goes. Okay, and then it'll come out. Vachara Vacharchen Yetzu B'Rechush Gadol. That's all they know. And this nevuah and this intervention makes sure that's happened. So it's so central to their consciousness, that's what I wanted to say, that Yaakov Avinu, we'll come to this later, in Vayechi, when the Torah describes how he comes to Egypt, I'm sorry, at the end of Vayeshev, At the end of, no, where is it? It's at the end of Miket, sorry. At the end of, at the end of Vayigash. The end of Vayigash, when Yaakov Avinu comes to, is about to leave Eretz Yisrael to go to Egypt, he gets scared. He gets to Beersheba, which is the southern border of Eretz Yisrael, and he offers korbanot to God. Is it to say, should I go down? I don't know. What should I do? And God said, "Al tirah miyadam. It's raya makel goy gadol. Simcha sham. Don't be afraid to go to Egypt." What was the issue? The issue was that he was afraid. Maybe it's not the time to start the whole drama of Jewish history and to actualize this promise that God had given at the Brit Ben Haptarim. So all this is hovering in the air, and that ish. Make sure that history diverges, or is diverted in that direction. We want to talk about Jewish time. So now we're going to talk about Jewish history. There's Jewish history and there's general history. Our history, and as I say this as a historian, does not work like anybody else's. Zalolecha. Really doesn't zalolecha. We should have been long gone. By no stretch of the imagination should the Jews still be here. We are the only people continually existent with the same memories, same laws, same everything from ancient times to today, with the possible exception of the Chinese, who keep asking Jews who I know and who have asked Jewish and are very interested in finding out from Jewish historians and intellectuals, how do you do it? Okay, we're the only ones here. We're not supposed to. We're the only people who've done it. I mean, Menachem Begin from Levracha, the former prime minister, used to like these speeches. Where is Rome? Where is Babylonia? Where is Persia? Where are the Greeks? Where are this? Where it's true. Where are they? They're all gone. So we live on simultaneously on two levels. We live in the history of the. We live in world history. We're part of the world, but we defy all the rules. So this is an example. This ish, these anashim, these interjections, are examples of how of times when our history doesn't work according to everybody's rules. Normal would have been for Yosef to go home. Normal would have been for the refugee not to come. This is where. So I'll never forget, and it's actually not inappropriate for the times we're living in now. So the normal would have been, as I said, for Yosef to go home. Normal would have been the Palit not to have come. When events take a turn which seems absolutely inexplicable, almost, if not absolutely absurd, mamish crazy to our eyes, that's a surefire sign that God is working in history. Because history has rules. There are certain historical laws. They're not ironclad, but generally there are patterns in history which you can more or less see. I mean, there are two. There are two interesting books in that regard. One is a book by the wonderful historian. His name was Barbara Tuchman, called The March of Folly, in which she just goes through all kinds of examples of where human silliness or arrogance leads to the downfall of empires. And there's another book by a professor at Yale, whose name is Paul, I think it's Paul Kennedy, called I think The Decline of Empires or something like. You know what? Let me take a look. The name of the book is The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers. That there's a pattern. You know, usually one of his arguments is that when empires like overextend themselves, when they just get to be too big, they're not manageable anymore, and therefore they sort of start falling apart. You know, there are patterns. Jewish history defines the patterns, and that's expressed by the intervention of God through sending the ish to divert things. Okay. So we've accounted for two anashim, the first one and the third one. What's this ish? Who's this ish that Yaakov is struggling with? There are many different ways to understand this ish. One way that the Rav understood it, explained it. He did it a number of different ways. The point of departure is a chazal that identifies the ish with Sarosh el Esav. It's a struggle that Yaakov had with the angel who was given dominion over Esav, by extension over Rome. Rome is Esav, and since Rome was taken over, ultimately became the symbol of Christianity, Esav also becomes a symbol of Christendom. You can take that image of this perpetual, of this almost unresolved fight, which Yaakov comes out ahead but still ends up being injured. You can interpret it all kinds of different ways. The way that the way that the Rav interpreted, you have to wonder, it's important. The way the Rav interpreted on one occasion, and it's what I want to talk about right now, is in the context of how do we relate to people of other faiths? How do we relate to people of other religions? Specifically, how do we relate to Christians and Christianity? Our relations with the Muslim world are less problematic from our point of view in a number of ways, because by all accounts, except for one opinion, the Rambam quotes, it's overwhelmingly assumed that Islam, with all of its problematics, and certainly they want to conquer Israel, and they want to make us into second-class citizens, and they think that we should pay extra taxes and be subordinate to Muslims. It's part of the Muslim Islam. It's like part of the Muslim religion. I mean, anybody who tells you that Islam is this religion of peace and brotherhood and blah 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 is simply, he either doesn't know what he's talking about, or doesn't understand. Okay, when the Muslims say the religion of peace, yes, once the world is Muslim and everybody is Muslim and accepts Islam and lives according to Muslim law, then we can all have peace because we'll all be on the same level. However, one of the cardinal principles of Islamic theology and law, and this is not, there are very few, I don't know of any serious disagreements of any of the schools of Islamic law, whether it's Shiite or Sunni, is that the world is divided into two parts. There are Muslims and everybody else. There is the part of the world which is Muslim, and there's the part of the world which is not yet Muslim. Part of the world which is Muslim is called the Dar al-Islam, the House of Islam. The part that is not yet Muslim is called the Dar al-Harb, the House of War. The process by which Dar al-Harb becomes Dar al-Islam is called struggle or jihad. Question. People who are Christians or Jews are allowed to live in the world of Islam as long as they are subordinate to secondary citizenship. They have to pay extra crippling taxes. They have multiple restrictions, but they are allowed to be safe in their, or secure in their bodies, in their homes, and in their religion, as long as they play by the rules. There's no citizenship. You are Muslim and everybody else, as I mentioned. One of the things which the Muslims cannot forgive Jews for is the fact that we don't play by those rules anymore. On the contrary, we conquered and live on land which is ours, like from God, but they think we took away from what's called from this House of Islam. Okay. Nevertheless, one problem we don't have with the Muslims is the question of whether it's avodah zarah, whether it's foreign worship, the ultimate enemy of the Torah. Now, foreign worship, the avodah zarah, is not necessarily idolatry. Idolatry is included, but it can actually be something else as well. Okay? So, for example, my teacher and colleague, Rabbi Professor David Berger, has the best definition of avodah zarah for our purposes, and that is to worship as God a being who is actually not God. Okay, so in other words, you could do that without pictures and statues and stuff like that, right? You could do that, and it would still be avodah zarah. Islam is by no means avodah zarah, because they worship the same God that we do. Allah is a Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's why the Rambam's family name was Abdullah, because his great-great-grandfather, his name was Abdullah. That's a perfectly acceptable Jewish name. In fact, the chief rabbi of Baghdad was at the turn of the 20th century. His name was Chacham Abdallah. The 19th was Chacham Abdallah Somech. And people who are named after Abdallah Somech carry the name now Ovadia, because Ovadia and Abdallah is the same thing. It's the same name. Rav Ovadia Yosef's name is Abdallah Yosef Ovadia, or Ovadia Yosef Abdallah. I forget already which, because he was named partly after this Chacham from Baghdad, who's a tremendous Talmud Chacham. Okay? So that's not a problem. Christianity, on the other hand, is a problem. Christianity is a serious problem because Christianity, certainly for Jews, okay, is a avodah zarah. And it probably is a avodah zarah for non-Jews as well, according to many, many achronim, because they attribute divinity to a human being who, in fact, was not God. But let's assume for a minute that it's not a avodah zarah for non-Jews, which is many, many poskim, the Ramah poskim's like that, okay? But certainly our history with the Muslims has not been happy. Okay? We've been persecuted by Christians, expelled by Christians, murdered by Christians, and classic anti-Judaism, while it has deep roots in the Hellenistic pagan world, was developed, adumbrated, and expanded by Christians. We have a long cheshbon with the Christians. Okay, there's a lot of bad blood. Justifiably so from our point. Nevertheless, and in fact, in addition, Christianity, like Islam, okay, believes ultimately that, okay, up until relatively recently, let's do it that way, Christians believe that all Jews would go to hell. All Christians believe that all Jews would go to hell. Because the only way you can be saved and go to Olam Haba is by worship, believing in Jesus. You're allowed to mention Jesus, thank you, by the way. It's a fear, a girl like that. Okay? So, Christians were constantly trying to missionize and get Jews to convert for our own good. Do you ever walk around in Manhattan and people, like missionaries, gave you like candy and stuff like that? Or they're usually very busy, I'll tell you where. In the summer, that's when I go to New York, so that's how I know. In the summer, they're very busy in the 72nd, the confluence of 72nd Street, Broadway, and Amsterdam. And also, for whatever reason, the 57th Street subway, where the E and the... E and the F meet the where the E train can switch over for the IRT, the 5, 6 and set 4, 5 and 6, so that's where you can. They're also usually there in the summer, also in the transfer between the E train and the IRT, because I need to go there usually in the course of the summer. In any event, they do it for your own good. They want to save your soul, but you know, for Jews who don't want to give up their religion, that's not simpatico. Okay. Now, against this background, in the early 1960s, I won't bore you with dates and stuff. The Catholic Church decided to take stock of itself after World War II and all kinds of changes and so on and so forth. And the Pope at the time, who was John the 23rd, called what was called the Second Vatican Ecumenical Council. Because all the bishops of all the churches around the world that have any affiliation with the Catholic Church. Obviously, the Protestants actually came as they were observers. But this was Catholic prelates all over the world and allied churches all came to the Vatican to discuss across the boards. You know, all kinds of hundreds of issues in order to restructure the church. This is where they decided not to give the Mass in Latin anymore and all kinds of other. Among the things that they wanted to discuss was the attitude towards non-Christians, especially Jews. And the possibility, without going into details, the possibility opened up for interreligious dialogue, interfaith dialogue between Jews and Christians. A majority of Jewish religious and lay figures jumped at the possibility, and the Rav said no. The Rav said no, but he said basically we exist, and I mentioned this when we talked about Ger and Toshav, when we talked about Avraham Avinu and Parshas Vayisachar. When we relate to people, we relate to the world on two levels. We are citizens of the world. We are involved in the sciences and in advancement of mankind and in moral issues and in fighting against pollution, whatever the case might be, social ills, poverty, drugs, against drugs, and so on. That's on the one level. However, on matters of faith, we can't communicate the depth of our faith experience to a Christian, and we can't understand the faith, the depth of a faith commitment of a Christian towards us. So there's really nothing to talk about. In other words, I can certainly, I mean, I've been studying Christianity and Islam for 40 years, at least. Okay, I'm only 58, but I did study this stuff in high school too. And I know a lot about Christianity. I know a lot about Islam. I know more about Christianity than Islam, but a lot about each. And despite all that knowledge, and I could sit there for the next 2 hours. I could give you introductory lectures on advanced lectures on Islamic theology and law and attitudes towards non-Muslims, and the same about Christianity and about the Reformation. Whatever you want. One thing I cannot get what it means to be Christian. I can't feel that. I can't experience it. It's not my. On the contrary, it's in some ways the antithesis of what everything I believe in, everything I hold sacred. It's not mine, and therefore I can never appreciate what it is. Similarly, a Gentile scholar of Jewish studies can know unbelievable amounts of material, and they do. There are they who really, really do, but they can't know what it is to be a Jew because they're not on the inside, different head, not their personal, intimate relationship with God, specific context. Let's put it in concrete terms, okay? I will never know what it is for a believing Christian to see a cross or a crucifix. You know the difference? A cross is just a cross. A crucifix is when you have Jesus hanging on the cross. And they can never know what it is that I see when I see a Sefer Torah, or a mezuzah, or a Magen David, whatever it is, or a menorah. They can't. It's not communicable. It's the depth of a religious experience. And those areas that they don't talk about. Even though, on a practical level, as human beings, we have a lot to talk about. And even though it may very well be that there are things that I believe as a Jew, that it comes out of my Masorah, out of my tradition, which a non-Jew, which a Christian will find totally unpalatable. And even if there are things which the Christian believes, which I find totally unpalatable. Now, many Christian sects to this day believe that Jews will never get to heaven because we don't believe in Jesus. All right? Now, the Catholic Church has adjusted that to mean that Jews can still somehow have some kind of salvation. I don't want to go into all the details, but Christians still come out ahead. Okay? And I find that unpalatable. Okay? You have to at least respect the fact that that's what they believe. I don't like it. But they might not like the fact that there are all kinds of things, there are all kinds of we say that non-Jews who don't accept the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach because God gave them also don't have a chelik olam haba. It's also not palatable. Now, it happens to be that it may very well be there's a very interesting overlap between the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach and Christianity and Islam. But let's leave that. There are Rishonim who think that they might fit. But look, so it's not palatable. At least I respect the other person. But that's not the point. The point is, the Rav said, that when it comes to things that we hold sacred, I can't give up what I hold sacred to please him. And just like I don't expect him to give up what he holds sacred to please me, we'll live in a state of mutual, let's call it respect. But I don't agree. And that's why he said. So that's why he said you can't debate. You can't debate or discuss or even deal in religious truths because not yours. In other words, our attitude towards the outside world grows out of our relationship with God and our covenant with God. Okay? It's not ours to barter away. Their attitude towards us comes from their a priori beliefs. So I don't have a right to come to the Christians and say, you can't believe and hope for me to convert to Christianity because it hurts me. That's what he believes. Just as I don't expect him to come to me and say, I don't like stuff that's in Masechta Avodah Zarah that is stated about obviously contemporary non-Jews. I mean, some things don't relate to contemporary non-Jews. Some things do. Okay, I don't like the fact, I find it offensive that if I touch a bottle of wine that hasn't been boiled, that you can't drink it. I can understand that's problematic. But you know what? Or that love can't conquer all. And we can't endorse intermarriage. Which is what the rest of the world wants us to do. I can't help it. That's my principles. You respect mine in their integrity, and I respect yours in their integrity. What was the fear? The Rav's fear was that if the church comes and says, you know what, we'll do a deal. We will give up on missionizing, which they don't. But we will give up missionizing. And you'll give up some other stuff. That doesn't work. It is immoral. It is intellectually dishonest to expect somebody to give up something which is part of their very essence. And that said, the rug is what the struggle is about between the Malach and Yaakov. I'm going to read you. And the rug wrote up his. It was an interesting story. This was not in the movie, and I'm really sorry that it wasn't there. When the question of interfaith dialogue came up in the '60s. In 1963, I think it was, 63, 64, the Rav asked a dear friend of mine to arrange for a closed lecture, that he would give a lecture at Columbia, not at YU, Columbia, and he would address the philosophy and religion department and some other invited guests, as I recall. I was a kid, but that's the story, the way I heard it. And he got up and he gave a tremendous, performance. He just blew them away because he proved that you can't have interfaith dialogues a matter of theology and belief between two religions. There's no communication there in terms of the profundity of the experience that each one has. As I told you, you can describe what a cross means to a Christian, but you can't really get into it. Okay, and vice versa. But he based it on classical Christian and contemporary philosophers and theologians, but ultimately his basic points he put together in an article which is called Confrontation, which was published first in the journal Tradition. It was translated into Hebrew, it's actually relatively accessible. I'm going to leave this copy here for those who want to read. And that's where he laid it out. He laid out exactly this dichotomy that I mentioned. But I'll read you what he says about our parsha apropos of the fight between the Malach and between Esav and Yaakov, and by extension the Malach and Yaakov, as follows. This is page 25. Our representatives who meet with the spokesmen of the community of the many, that's the Christians, should be given instructions similar to those enunciated by our patriarch Jacob when he sent his agents to meet his brother Esav. And he commanded the foremost, saying, when Esav, my brother, meets you and asks you, saying, whose are thou and where do you go, and who are those before you, then you shall say, they are your servant Jacob's. It is a present sent to my lord Esav, and behold, is also behind us. And he commanded the second and the third that kept giving this. What was the nature of these instructions? Our approach to and relationship with the outside world has always been an ambivalent character. Intrinsically antithetic, in other words, it's almost opposites, bordering at times on the paradoxical. Paradoxical because it's both A and not A, we're with and without. We relate ourselves to, and at the same time withdraw from, we come close to and simultaneously retreat from the world of Esau. When the process of coming nearer and nearer is almost consummated, we immediately begin to retreat quickly into seclusion. We cooperate with members of other faith communities in all fields of constructive human endeavor, but simultaneously with our integration into the general social framework, we engage in a movement of recoil and retrace our steps. You know, we never totally integrate. In a word, we belong to the human society, and at the same time we feel as strangers and outsiders. We are rooted in the here and now reality as inhabitants of our globe, and we experience a sense of homelessness and loneliness as if we belong somewhere else. We are both realists and dreamers, prudent and practical on the one hand, and visionaries and idealists on the other. We are indeed involved in the cultural endeavor, and yet we are committed to another dimension of experience. Our first patriarch, Abraham, already introduced himself in the following words. We learned this already. I am a stranger and a sojourner with you. Ger v'toshav anochi imachem. Is it possible to be both ger v'toshav at the same time? Is not this definition absurd, since it contravenes the central principle of classical logic that no cognitive judgment may contain two mutually exclusive terms? As I told you, something can't be both A and not A. And yet, the Jew of old defied this time-honored principle and did think of himself in contradictory terms. He knew well in what areas he could extend his full cooperation to his neighbors and act as a toshav, a resident, a sojourner. And at what point this gesture of cooperation and goodwill would end, would terminate, and he must disengage as if he were a ger, a stranger. Okay. He knew in what enterprise to participate to the best of his ability, and what offers and suggestions, however attractive and tempting, to reject resolutely, I'll interject, because you can't, Jews aren't, can't become part of, we're not allowed. By being Jewish, we by definition can't assimilate into the broader expanse. That would be a violation of the bridge between Israel and God. He was aware of the issues on which he could compromise, of the nature and the goods he could surrender, and vice versa, of the principles which were not negotiable, and the spiritual goods which had to be defended at no matter what cost. The boundary line between a finite idea and a principle nurtured by infinity, transient possessions and eternal treasures, was clear and precise. Things don't change. Things don't change. Secular society today says, give it up. You know, take a little Christianity, take a little Judaism, we'll have a mixed marriage, we'll have this, we'll have that. Everybody will love everybody else. Undifferentiated humanity was not what God had in mind. Ger v'toshav. Doesn't make you a lot of friends sometimes. So that this was the position, but that's you maintain your integrity. As the Rav said on another occasion, we might not earn the world's love, but we'll certainly gain their respect for standing on principle. In any event, so that is in fact so that's Yaakov's struggle. He's struggling, the sorrow shall Esav, this Ish, is the part of him which goes with Esav. It's the part of him which belongs in the broader world, the physical world, in the constructive world. It's the world of science and culture and civilization, in which we share everything with everybody else. Yaakov, on the other hand, is the person who had the Brit of Avraham. He got the Bechorah. He got the blessing. The question is, he struggles with how much of him is Yaakov and how much of him is Esav. You could psychologize this if you want and say it's the Esav within, but that's a physical, it's not a brutal part of us, it's part of us, as being part of the general culture, in this case Christianity. At the end, you pay a physical price for it. Yaakov is wounded in the struggle. But in the end, he emerges victorious. You've striven both with God, with the mighty, or with God, or before God, in the name of God. Let's do it that way. To stand up for your own integrity as a religious community, and you've struggled with men on humanity's playing ground together with men. In other words, to be able to advance the cause of humanity, and you've overcome in both cases. And you've prevailed in both cases. But the struggle is an ongoing. It's never ultimately resolved. Because we're constantly both. I mentioned this today also because, well, this is Parshat Shavua, but because there's a long debate going on now. Really, these past few weeks, over the way our relations with especially evangelical Christians. The established Christian churches in the world have become increasingly anti-Israel, and they verge on the anti-Semitic, if not crossing the line. It's another talk, another discussion. The Presbyterian, many Presbyterian churches, Methodists, all kinds of other churches. The question, on the other hand, there are a large number of evangelical Christian church, groups in the world who support Israel and support Israel wholeheartedly and send us money and support and they support Israel in Congress and all kinds of stuff. And they're good friends. And they're good friends. Sometimes they're better friends and more reliable friends than some elements in the Jewish community, I'm afraid to say, who are more than willing to go and aid and abet our enemies and our worst enemies. There are Jewish so-called they're Kuri Kachas. This is our problems. There's lots of Jewish professors and so-called intellectuals in their own eyes who do things they say, as a Jew, I hate Israel. As a Jew, I think the Hamas is a... There's a woman that just got an award, a professor at Berkeley. Her name is Judith Butler. She actually thinks the Hamas is a peace-loving, left-wing charitable organization. And she said so. It's amazing. Okay, so you have to be careful of these people who have no Jewish affiliation, don't know anything, and they say, as a Jew, because they were born to Jews, that makes them a statement for the spokesman for all Jewish people. In any event, so you have these evangelical Christians who are wonderful people, they support Israel. But the debate is, what should our relationship be with them? On the theological level. There are those who argue that today we can have face-to-face theological dialogue on issues of religion and faith, because they love us, so we don't have to worry. The Rav thought that dafka because they love us, we have to be more careful, because when somebody gives you something, you want to give something back, and we don't have much to give. We can't give of our own, cultural religious integrity. There were those who argue, no, we should stick to the Rav's model. Don't go into faith dialogue, and don't sit there and talk about Jews taking back Jesus and so on and so forth. Let's keep it straight, because it may very well be that some of these, and in fact some of these Catholics, some of the evangelical churches, do missionize. They do, but that's what you should see. That's the thing I tell my colleagues, and I tell people in general in Israel when they ask me, you shouldn't get upset that Christians missionize. If Christians missionize, it's because they need to. It's part of their faith commitment, and you should respect that. You don't accept it, but you shouldn't get a huffy about it. They're not doing something bad as far as they're concerned. It's doing something bad as far as we're concerned. Do you follow? You understand the difference? So you reach some kind of modus vivendi. That's why I don't get upset when the Pope gets up and says, I hope the Jews convert at the end of days. Hello, I hope they'll recognize Judaism at the end of days, so. Right? I mean, you don't expect Jesus to come over on the white mule. Certainly I don't believe that's what's going to happen. They do. So therefore, it's logical to expect the Jews will convert. Okay, I find that totally unobjectionable. Some Jews get really bent out of shape by that. That's who they are. I recognize the reality. I deal. I don't accept it, but I accept the reality that that's what they think. So there are Christians who do missionize. The question is, am I facilitating missionizing by going into relationship with evangelicals or not? It's a serious issue. Interestingly, this became a big topic of discussion in a group that I belong to. And I just as one individual was saying that no, that's okay, it's not going to happen. We can just discuss, learn religion together and live in harmony. And I just found out yesterday or the day before that hundreds of copies of the New Testament in Hebrew were delivered to teachers around Israel from an evangelical group in the United States. So apparently, and yesterday, I was in. I forget if it was in Moshava or if it was in Katamon. Katamon, Moshava, back, that's all the same. There was a big sign announcing a lecture in which the speaker was going to discuss the implications of Isaiah chapter 53. Isaiah chapter 53 is a chapter called Eved Hashem HaSovel, the suffering servant of God, where which was used has been used forever, for 2,000 years by Christians to show, as it were, it's not true, that Christian dogma is prefigured in the Tanakh, as if the Tanakh predicts and anticipates the career of the Christian Messiah. So there's stuff going on. So that's the reason why the Rav said, look, I recognize who you are, what you do, you recognize what I do, we will work together towards X, Y, and Z. We both believe the State of Israel should exist. We both realize that right now we're in the world of an upsurge of jihad, which is threatening world peace. So we will work together, just like in those areas where we are a toshav, on issues of dogma, on issues of religion. I have no right to tell you what to believe. You have no right to tell me what to believe. We'll call it a draw. The same way, at the end of the day, the fight between Yaakov and the angel wasn't a knockout. It was, you say Yaakov got it on points. He pinned, well, no, it's not true. He pinned the angel. But it was an ongoing struggle. And that's exactly the way Jewish history has played itself out. Any questions? Okay.